Hey, Bridgie, thanks for joining me today. We've got a guest with us who's from the far-flung regions of West Australia. Today we have Lee Burton with us. Lee, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, it's actually a privilege for us to have someone certainly from your industry too. But before we get into any of the bigger topics we're going to talk about, I think it's really important that the people, kind of hear from you and understand who you are and what you do. So, or even how you got there today. So can you give us a quick introduction?
Well, I grew up in Perth. I spent some time in Queensland, and I entered mining very briefly, where I pretty much saved up to become a construction diver. I did that for a few years, and then I joined the military, where I served in the 2nd Battalion as an infantry soldier. Then, when I wanted to sort of expand my knowledge, experience, and skills, I was sitting in quarantine in Rottnest Island, thinking, wow, all my well-laid plans have completely fallen apart. What can I do to earn a living? And my brother was like, have you thought about emergency response? So I pretty much got straight out of quarantine, and went and did a 12-ish day course, became an emergency response officer. That's what led me to what I'm doing today. So mines rescue teams, in charge of the response capabilities on mine sites, whether it be surface or underground. There's firefighting, there's road crash rescue, there's, the medical side of it. Pretty much anything that goes wrong in the mine site,
Well, hang
they
on.
res respond to.
Can I just interject? Because there's so much there already. My goodness. Bridgie and I really want to dive into some of this ESO work or emergency response officer work that you're talking about. But I had no idea that you were a diver. And to be honest, I'm actually a little bit unsure of what a construction diver is. Are you able to give us some background there? Because a lot of medicos seem to come into these things sometimes from diving backgrounds, and this is just a, one of those unique ones that we've stumbled across.
Yeah, this is well, it's been quite a long time since I was in that industry, well over a decade. I guess there is some definite differences between like a PADI or an SSI diver, or even a tech diver versus a surface applied breathing apparatus diver. So ADAS, or the Australian Diver Accreditation Society, which comes under IMCA, or the International Marine Contracting Agency, they are the governing body for construction diving. So there are standards in Australia that sort of govern how construction diving is done, whether it be scuba, whether it be surface supplied, whether it be onshore, whether it be offshore. Those standards sort of highlight what paid work is, and then like how that work must be done, the size of the teams, the equipment, even your health support plans, how far away you can be from a hyperbaric chamber. Like the standards say that basically if you're offshore, you pretty much have to have a chamber on site, things like that. And then what sort
A
of mess?
chamber on site.
Yeah, so offshore diving, when you look at it, which is your part three, pretty much if you're doing certain high risk types of diving or certain depths, pretty much, yeah, the standards word for word will be like, you will have this.
What kind of depths are you talking about?
So your part three qualifies you for surface applied to 50 meters, and you work potentially out of like a bell. This is a very rough explanation of all of this. So it's hard hat diving, right? Like it's a Kirby Morgan hat. And then, yeah, you can do some very interesting things. I never worked offshore. I didn't make it that far career progression. So offshore is quite risky, and you need significant experience. So they don't really send young people without much more experience out there. It's a very costly activity to have the equipment to go do that. There are a lot of changes in the industry. A lot of things can now be done with remote operated vehicles, that kind of stuff. So they try to minimize, like, do we need to send people down to that depth to do that job, or can it be done by a robot? But there's onshore, there's plenty of good dive work. There's vessel inspections, mooring line inspections. Some excellent companies that work at the MCUF in West Australia and do those sort of vessel inspections. So, to me, explaining what construction divers do, the easiest way to say that is that diving is just how you get to the job. Like everything in the construction industry that you do, like I've painted underwater with a paintbrush and what was very likely lead-based paint in Fremantle in a freezing winter, where basically we were just following a hard line along the bottom of a vessel and painting anodes. So you just pretty much you had basically a dive time of 3 hours, 15 minutes to the paint, get back.
How does that work? How do you
That's,
paint underwater?
I don't
Don't
understand this either.
tip the can upside down, or else the paint comes in. It's pretty awkward, right? So we were doing that in an argon mask, on a line, and it was freezing cold. No one wanted to wear their wetsuits because they were just getting destroyed by the paint. But it was pretty much you run a line on a magnet and you have a light bar. So the light bar, which is spooky as because when you it's at night already, but even as you go under the vessel, it just becomes dark, cold, miserable dark. And then you're yandering under there, following this line that you're hoping is still connected. And then suddenly the light appears and you're like, oh, I'm in the right area. Excellent. And we had
Great.
a magnet on a string to basically tell us because it was really hard in the light to see the difference between the color and the paint. So you would have a different color so that you could tell basically, okay, that's gray. I've got the white paint so that you would differentiate the layers. And because it's time is money, right? So basically, your boss is sitting up there, like checking in because it's surface applied. So you have some level of communication beyond a hard line. And they're like, how you going, buddy? And you're like, yep, kicking away because
Just
they,
painting underwater,
yeah, just painting
I'm
underwater
doing
with a
good.
brush. People, I tell that story and people are like, ah, oh, he's having a laugh, right? But like on my Instagram, I'm pretty sure from many years ago, there's just me in just a paint suit, just in an argon mask like this, just covered in paint. Like, but that was it. Like I had jobs where we just carted rocks underwater. So they were dredging. So one person would sit there with the dredge, just like lowering the dirt level, so that vessels had deeper moorings. And we would take turns. And then the other person would pretty much put rocks in a basket and carry the rocks further out to yeet the rocks that wouldn't fit through the dredge machine. So it's just the means of getting to the job.
I have so
Yeah,
many other questions.
that does take me back.
Does it pay well?
Definitely, right? Because there was, well, before my time, there are dive unions and they're the ones that get involved, like especially offshore. So there have been some incidents in the last few years, like when it comes to like decompression schedules, hyperbaric chambers, like you can cook people pretty badly. And a lot of that has to be done. So offshore chambers are run by people with life support technician quals who are very good at all of that sort of stuff. And they're sort of the people that also do the next level above, which is saturation diving, which is a whole different qualification and well above my pay grade. But like when they do those roles, you need a doctor, like a proper dive doctor, to be assessing those dive profiles and be like,
Yeah,
this
for
is safe,
sure.
this is unsafe. And they also use mixed gas. So that's going to increase your dive times and all of those things. So like try mixed gases, like there's some big science and big risk if not done right. And there have been some incidents where bad things have happened, which at a minimum, affects can like DCS, these things can affect people for the rest of their life. But then worst case is hyperbaric chambers are not somewhere you want to be doing big kid medicine. especially very, very far from any help that's not telemetric. Like, there's not always going to be a doctor on site to do those higher level interventions.
Yeah, it's very risky.
Yeah, but my experiences were great. I worked in Karratha. We built a fort, basically, for the mines many, many years ago. So we were involved in, like, putting pylons in, putting what they call the dolphins onto the pylons. We would chain block the containment rings into place. Like, you'd do up the massive bolts, and then they'd fill it with concrete. So there's everything from working with cranes to, yeah, to cleaning the side of hulls. Like, it's, yeah, once again, just how you get to the job.
So. It's what I find wild is, you know, I guess in the construction space underwater, I guess a lot of people don't understand that, you know, very similar methods that exist out of water exist underwater. You know, even just last week, I was just assisting a friend of mine just drill some shark receivers into one of the local reefs for a project they were doing, and we were using chem sets to set the bolts. And I mean, it's the same chem sets that we used to use on the side of buildings when we were rappelling off. And, you know, those chem sets, they would cure within 10 to 30 minutes, and we could actually, you know, fully weight them if we needed to rappel off. And the only difference I found from these chem sets we were setting underwater is that they were going to take up to 20 hours to cure rather than, you know, 10 to 30 minutes. And actually, I'm curious, your paint underwater, I'm assuming that takes longer to dry.
I guess all our job was you have 3 hours and 15 minutes of dive time. Do not go below 10 meters or else you're in trouble, and try to paint a whole circle to the point where we were very competitive. So we wanted to do it with the guy before. And then, you know, they'd hold down the comms button and then you could play music. So cool. That's all we did. Yeah. And yeah, then you'd get out and you would ignore everything you ever heard about hot showers and all of that sort of stuff. And then you'd pretty much just run to the shower and just like stand in there trying to get the feeling back into your fingertips.
You don't even need to have hot water to get that feeling back in. I mean, I'm sure the water you've been in is a lot colder. You know, I think the last cold water I was in was 6 degrees, and that was enough to warrant, you know, significant lapses in the dive time for me. But you know, hopping in the showers afterwards, I felt like it was warm and it was still probably just cold water. Hey, something you referenced before too was diving in an argon mask, and you know, there's a lot of footage out there of commercial divers doing things underwater, and you know, a lot of the time there's jokes about their voices being high pitched because there's a helium mix to that. But you're talking about argon. Can you explain how the argon mask is different to what people would probably assume you're talking about?
That might have been a word. So Arga is a brand. So Arga mask is just like a scuba, like a full face scuba mask. So whether or not your line is connected to a cylinder or whether to a hard line like SSBA, it's just a scuba mask that you can utilize. Arga mask.
How do you scratch your face?
You can't. It's positive pressure. If you're really keen, you could just risk it for the biscuit and try and get a finger in there.
Bridgie, you ever had an itch on your nose? You can't scratch it.
You're like...
Well, we always used to call them an arga mask because they pretty much like shoot water straight into your right eye. Something to do with like the shape of the nasal piece. And you'd always be like, We didn't use them too much. Like, they're not as comfortable. So those guys didn't want to run like a Kirby Morgan band mask, which is very comfortable, very easy, simply because they didn't want to expose their equipment to the horrors of the paint. Like, it's very expensive. They're like, well, that's a much cheaper, easier version. But definitely not as good equipment. Like, the Kirby Morgan equipment is very good, be it the face mask or your full helmet, pretty much. They are, when you start initially putting them on, it is quite disorientating. You're putting a big bucket over your head and you feel like, well, how do I get this off? But as you get more comfortable with them, you sort of understand that as long as you have positive pressure, the water can never get in. Like, that's it. And then the standards are pretty high, right? Like, you always have three means of air. So one is the cylinder on your back, of which you have your bailout. And then you must have, through your surface applied, whether it be a compressor running constantly or two separate air banks, you have to work out the dive time of every individual dive profile. And your safety or bailout must always be a third of that time, like things like that. So you do have significant safety built in so that no matter what part fails, even if your line gets cut, like you still have a bailout and some way to breathe with enough time
To get back.
to hopefully sort out those issues. Yeah.
I'm still getting Chris Lemon vibes.
Chris Lemon.
I should never have watched that documentary. Was it Last
Oh,
Breath?
the Last Breath. Yeah. Listen,
That
that's a
was
terrifying
insane.
documentary.
That was an insane documentary.
Yeah. Those depths and like the dive support vessels and the things that go into all of that. Like I never went offshore, but it is terrifying.
Yeah.
And yeah, that concept of just yeah, what he did, got out of it. Yeah, the
I wonder
mental
if
strength.
he ever went back.
Very good question.
I don't think so.
I wouldn't.
I don't. I've have read some stuff, and I mean that can also be out of date sometimes. I mean, I even was fortunate to work with some of the guys from his team years ago. I mean, everyone shares a biased, offer of what actually happened, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like working on another planet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
everything becomes harder in a different way, and you have to think about some stuff like carrying chain blocks. So you get like a 15 kilo chain block. You know, you sort of assess, I'm working within 10 meters. I don't want to breach that depth for timing wise and things like that. And you got to pull the containment rings up. And then it's just like, well, how do I get this chain block over there? And then when you're young and dumb, you're like, ah, oh, I'm tough. I'm a good swimmer, whatever. And then you're like, oh no, I've made a mistake. Like I'm going down. Which can obviously affect your dive time. And then your boss is sitting there who has a, you know, a panel and he can read your depth. And he's like, what are you doing, buddy? So
Sinking.
thinking, yeah. So it's just like learning to plan and get around those things as in like, yeah, I need a line, right? I need to tie things off so that I can scoot things across. Like what factors affect me? You know, everything from tide, temperature, depth, the tools you can utilize. Yeah, it's yeah, very, it is difficult, but you do a lot of fun stuff. I have often thought about going back, not sure what my wife would think about that, especially as we live in Cairns and there happen to be these
Oh, you're in
prehistoric,
Cairns.
yeah.
I'm in Cairns.
You're in Cairns, right? Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Lee's not in
And
Cairns
there you
right
go.
now, though, Bridgie.
No,
Where
not
are you right
actually.
now?
In the West Australian desert on an iron ore
Oh,
mine.
wow.
I'm up here running first aid breathing apparatus and hazmat training for a response team.
And how big are those response teams?
So this site is a significant site, so they want like decent sized panels. So they probably have somewhere between 8 to 10, but those numbers fluctuate, right? Like as people become supervisors, they can't be a part of ER, as their career changes or interests change. So there's a lot of fluctuation. Yeah, this site, I always enjoy coming back here. They have very good people and I know the ESOs very well. Yeah, it's just a well-run site. Their equipment, they have a lot of equipment and a lot of good equipment. And they're very supported by their higher ups
Help me
in
with
having
these
them here.
acronyms because I've seen medical response officer, I've seen emergency response officer, and then I hear ESO.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with letters and words here.
And that's fair. For us, it's always been like emergency service officer
Right.
is the role. Some people throw medical in front of that. There also are some differences where some people will, like, if you're a registered nurse or paramedic, they would probably call you like a clinical emergency service officer.
Just throw
If
another
you have,
letter in there.
yeah, just if you're, most ESOs have to have a minimum of a certificate for in healthcare. to be able to get on the poisons permit in some description. Each mine site has a provider that covers that, and that's where they have that doctor cover at whatever scope and level that says, yeah, you guys can do this or you can't do that. And that is very, very different depending on which site. Some are conservative, some are less conservative. But yeah, they're generally like their clinics up here. Like I'm sitting in the clinic for this site. They have a very modern good Zoll, electric suction, endless oxygen, full crash cart. Any real spicy drugs are with the clinic. So there are not too many of that sort of stuff here. And then basically, they generally run one advanced life support, be it nurse or paramedic, at the clinic in camp. And they do most of that workload. Medical ESOs, coughs, colds, musculoskeletal pain, basic assessment, anything serious, handball to the ALS. At night time, we try not to wake the paramedic or nurse for fatigue management. If it's serious enough, we'll call the doctor. And then each site has specific protocols that they follow. So basically, if there's indication to take an ECG, it pretty much call the doctor. Like if there's enough evidence that you should do that, then there's enough to say call the doctor. This poisons permit provider here is very good. They do have a their doctors are specialists in remote medicine. Without saying too much, sometimes providers can yeah, there's a quality gap sometimes. And I think that's a very interesting concept, and it's one that probably links into where I'd like to go with what I do, and how I would like to see emergency response team members and ESOs, what their scope to say should be, and what type of training they should receive versus what I guess industry standard is what we might call. So yeah, it's I think that could definitely be I guess more not military but more sort of tactical emergency casualty care like tech or something similar.
There's always a delicate balance with these roles in extreme environments, though, because on one hand, where you've either, a Cert 4 in healthcare is still a clinical skill set, an advanced first aid certificate is still a clinical skill set, a degree, master's, it doesn't matter. They're all clinical approaches. But, where you see clinical roles in isolation, so things like, ambulance, ED nurse, a physician in a hospital, they're very, very clinically focused, and almost 90% of what you do is going to be clinically focused. But when you step outside of those structures, there's a lot of other things that you need to be competent and capable of doing. And so it's not that the clinical skills are neglected, but they certainly sit side by side with other non-clinical professional skills. And so where you've got a team of ESOs, even with an ALS paramedic or nurse or doctor on that team, I'm assuming all of those people are required to hold road crash rescue, firefighting, breathing apparatus, mining rescue, surface and subsurface qualifications. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, unfortunately, and I think you put this in a really, really good way, they're not, right? So the paramedic or the nurse does not have to have a rescue capability. And
Ah,
unfortunately,
that's
sometimes
interesting.
there is a mentality of, oh, the ER will bring the patient to me. And well, not unfortunately, that's a way to say it, is there is not enough high acuity incidents, especially for things like vertical rescue or things like that, where you have entrapped patients where maybe the 1 year volunteer with 2 days of first aid is not the person that should be on that rope packaging that patient. Because you have a whole spectrum of things. And the big one is going to be
Yeah,
pain
maybe.
management. Pain management. Like they can't do that. And we don't see it enough, a good thing in many ways. For people to get that message clear, like you need to be able to do a certain amount of things, right? And that conversation can link very easily into things like, well, opioids versus ketamine, or, you know, nerve blocks. There's a whole range of all of that medical stuff that are considerations for these environments that probably haven't even been considered, well, at least not in Australia.
If you look at something as simple as methoxyfluorine, though, now there are going to be people screaming at their, you know, microphones at the moment that I dared call it simple. It's not my intention to downplay the dangers of it, but in terms of administration, that's a simple drug to give. It's a simple dose to calculate because you don't. And depending on who's the governing authority will depend on how many doses and when you can give it. Hopefully most will use the manufacturer's recommendations because, I mean, this is a controversial drug across the planet. You know, a lot of, well, I mean, the US still can't even access it. We've been using it for over 30 years. Well, not 30, 20 years in Australia. But well,
Surf Life Saving even has it. Like there's football clubs that have it. Yeah.
Yeah. And these are lay clinical people. You know, they're rescue officers. But you're spot on, Bridgie.
And I think also there's a few footy clubs we have that have the whistle as well.
And that so was that was my question to Lee is, you know, there's a flip side to suggesting that the person with a 2-day rescue or, you know, patient packaging qualification is the wrong person to be, you know, bringing that patient out. There's a flip side in the sense that, you know, sometimes it often is the best person because it's the only person. And so where it is the only person, well, that is the best person to actually action that. And so whether or not we should have a nurse, a paramedic, a doctor, someone else highly trained there to extricate them, sometimes is a moot point because sometimes what you're actually doing in those initial minutes or that extrication is BLS. And I'm being cautious here, Bridgie, because people love to pounce on us when we say the wrong thing, and I say it often. But, you know, there's skills in BLS now that used to be aligned with ALS back in the day before things developed. So as things develop, they get more mainstream and they get simpler and they get lumped into, no, well, that's basic because we're doing more advanced things. And that's also a double edge. That's good and bad sometimes. But, you know, you just said that Surf Life Saving Australia have brought methoxy to the beaches. That was unheard of 10 years ago. No way would we do that. That's clinical authority only. But it's now being lumped in with BLS providers. And I can see tremendous benefits if there is structure, process, and procedure to support the administration of that. And so where we've only got a lay responder potentially performing these rescues, pain management is a big thing, Lee, you're spot on. But I think with the right, you know, policies and procedures and support mechanisms, I think you could bring some pain relief into that and potentially even increase that capability.
I guess there'd be some considerations with, like, if these are underground or confined spaces, like that's the point where we might
get
not.
The cold filter on there, the scrubbers.
Well, see, we don't have those, like, for example, in the ambulance service, right? So
they're not.
In the UK, they did, and they'd only just introduced them. They were strictly for traumatic purposes only. Whereas, like, we use them for medical and traumatic in sort of more like in the Australian ambulance services. But yeah, so there's a rule that you can't administer more than a certain amount in the back of an ambulance because you will get to the hospital and you'll be like,
drooling.
A headache. Yeah.
Well, and we have a vent in the back and everything. But like a lot of the time, because they last for about 20 to 30 minutes, probably more like 20 if they're being used correctly. It's good to try and get that out of the way before you're in a confined space with someone.
So you're saying not bring it underground? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I just don't know if it's our greatest plan.
Stick it in the side of the breathing apparatus?
Yeah. In the VA, you're like, here, have this.
Hey, Bridgie, just educate me really quickly because it's been so long since I was in the back of an ambulance. So they don't have the coal filters?
No, not in the state service. Not that I know of. I'm not sure of its cost. But the strange thing about that is that I have seen them in the hospitals. So well,
in the private sector, and I'm speaking from a Queensland perspective at the moment because every state's doing things slightly differently now. You'll see those coal scrubbers on just about every single whistle that's administered because that's the way they're.
Yeah.
And so you would actually have to buy them independently, different from the central pharmacy or
Well,
from the
because
provider to not have them.
ours come in a big box of just whistles. Like there's about 20 whistles in a box, and they don't come with any filters.
Okay,
Yeah.
there's the supply difference right there because a lot of them in the private sector will come in a larger box. It's actually ampoule filter and whistle all in one box.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I
And
can see
then we
Pete
order
shaking
the
his head.
drug
Oh, shake,
separately.
nodding his head.
Yeah.
He's nodding his head.
Yeah. And then we order the drug separately. Yeah. So that must be where the disjoint is. But another thing, just going back when we were saying about who's the person going down to do the rescue, I'm also interested about the vertical rescue side. Like, are the paramedics trained in vertical rescue? Like all the medical officers, like should we shouldn't be sending someone down that doesn't know how to use the ropes either, really? Like, what would you prefer? I can give the whistle or I can go on the ropes.
Well, in a way they can, right? Because we run direct main, direct belay, and they're not in charge of what their movement rate, right? Like, so
Right.
we put two ropes on them, yeet them off the edge, and they're
Great.
belayed off of that. So there are times
Okay.
when, you can wrap or you can do other things, but mining standards are it is twin line rescue and you must
Yeah.
be on a specific type of belay, which you can both ascend and descend on, but it has built-in safety. Basically, if you go unconscious or you let go of it, it will arrest you.
Okay.
So there are many good devices like that. So we you're on two ropes going down. And you're not in control of that. So hypothetically,
You could send someone
you
down.
could.
Not
Probably
that you
when you look at
wouldn't want to, but you could.
you could. However, yes, they should be trained and qualified in, specific codes of vertical rescue. I think it's contextual, right? Like there's always going to be a reason why we can or can't. Like if you have one serious patient, no other ongoing risks, maybe there's value. If you have multiple patients and they're needed elsewhere, maybe committing your one ALS provider isn't the smartest idea. Like, I think it's an ability that should be pushed for because when another example is road crash rescue, right? So our subject matter expert for specifically pulling that human being out of that car who has the most knowledge of what's happened to their body in that really bad time, like they should be trained in road crash rescue and experienced to say, hey, the best way to get this human being out of that entanglement is this way. This they should be involved in that process. It shouldn't just be, I'm just gonna chill bang here until you bring me the patient. Like they need to have an
Yeah.
understanding of the entirety of each individual aspect of the types of rescue. So that they know what we're doing, how we do it, and where they fit into that, which
And
also,
how to extricate people without giving them like a secondary injury. So
Well, that's really controversial, right? And I don't know of any exact studies that have evidence-based medicine that says this is the best way. This, like spinal immobilization, all of these things.
yeah.
For me, the science says one thing, and it's the less time they spend in that
In
entanglement,
the car,
The
yeah.
better off they are, right? Like their mortality rate is worse if they spend extended periods. So we can have a mentality of like, I have to protect this spine, or we can have a mentality of maybe keeping the blood inside the body might just happen to be the priority.
Like, yeah,
There's
that seems like a good priority. There is some with they took away from us like the. They're called the KEDs. They're, those
Yes, GED, yeah,
had all
Kendrick
of,
extraction device.
yeah.
That's a really interesting one to bring up. I've never used it in anger, but I know one thing, whether I've utilized it in training or I've had to train it is a very difficult device. And to place that on anyone, you have a lot of patient movement.
Heaps.
So if you are playing the I must fight for this spinal alignment game, it's really, really difficult to put on, especially if, like, our response teams don't get to train that much. Like, they come up to site and they'll be lucky if they train once a month, one Sunday or one Saturday or whatever it is. If they train 12 times a year, they're killing it. So professional ESOs, generally you only have one or two on site and everyone else is a
Okay.
volunteer that does the same course, but they don't do it professionally or constantly or have the same level of continuous professional development. So that's another factor, right? Is we have dedicated response teams, but they're not full time every day.
They
You're
get
like a
called
team.
out of work, right?
Yeah, they get called
Like,
out of
so
work.
they're on shift
Yeah.
and they get called out. Yeah.
That's
So they're
exactly
not
right.
expecting an emergency either. Like, so the person in
No.
the clinic is it, well, not always expecting an emergency, but that is what you're paid to do, right? You're there for that exact purpose. So I guess that's another element is that the ESO team or the ERT team, like, they're not actively expecting an emergency. Like, they've gone to do their role and they're getting pulled out of their environment.
Yeah, they're fitters, they're truck drivers, they're grader operators, they're geologists, enviros, just going about their daily business. Sites have an activation procedure, like they hit their red button here, it's going to come over the radio, sorry, and then they're going to hear emergency, 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 and then they start cutting shapes basically to get to a vehicle to come support us. We will direct them from there, but their radios are programmed like our radios. They cut off from everyone else, and they'll hear that report, and they'll hear, yeah, there's a fire or there's a medical or whatever it is, and we get the numbers we get. And sometimes they might have significant distance to travel. It might take them 15 or 20 minutes to get here, and in a truck fire, 15 or 20 minutes is the
A long
difference between
time.
there's something left or there's nothing left. Like, in all honesty, like if they do go up that size vehicle, like you could just get the marshmallows out and just let it go. Because you're not recovering it in any way. Yeah, the priority is like life, limb, asset. And especially underground, if anything is on fire underground, putting that fire out in those environments is it involves like vent fan control, flooding compartments with
Because
foam.
there's gas under there, isn't there? Like, there's an
That's yeah,
explosion
there is.
risk.
Yeah, so oh, like gas can come, there can be methane pockets, right? Like there are
Yeah.
places where you need constant gas detecting, that kind of stuff. So those alarms go off, like you get to a chamber, right? So they have a chamber that people can survive in for a length of time, and then they work out what it is. Like smoke will kill you in an underground fire. Like if it's significantly burning, that's what will flood those areas, and you have to get to somewhere where you can breathe. Yeah, so there are those risks, but there's also just general risks in underground, but the big ones are fire, like engulfment or flooding, toxic gases, and then just collapse is probably well up there. Like they bolt the roofs and everything. Like the machine goes along as it digs, and they have a process. But there's a lot of underground movement actually, which I learned eventually is that they have like the seismic movements is more common than you think. You just don't hear about
Great.
it as much. Yeah. But sometimes those alarms go off, and we only get notified as an ESO at certain levels. So every
A
mine has
certain
like,
amount of
yeah.
movement.
So we're like,
Okay.
this is dodgy. We need
So
to
there's a
look into this. Yeah.
tolerance level. There's a tolerance
There.
level of movement underground.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
What would you say is the most, I guess, common sort of emergency that you feel like you would respond to?
Ooh, surface is probably like fires, vehicle fires that very rarely fire. Like wheel bearings are big ones. So like these trucks have a lot of weight, and the wheel bearings heat up, and they might see smoke and heat. Or a super common one that sets off. Every vehicle has a compressed air foam system or a CAPS unit that either will self activate, or if the operator sees something, they hit that button. Sometimes oil leaks onto like the turbo or something like that, and they'll just smoke and fire. And then the operator sees that and they're like, oh, hit the button, which is fair enough. I'd do that. That's
I'd
super
hit the
common, though.
button, yeah.
Yeah, I say, dude, just hit the button, man. Like, you want to find out the hard way, not hitting the button. But we get, in all honesty, we get more medical stuff than anything.
Okay.
And that's or more serious medical. And that's not super common, but it's more cardiac than
Yeah.
anything.
That was going to be my
Like,
question. Is this like comorbidities? Is this like primary healthcare medical, or is this?
yeah, like we get, I've been to very few like trauma. Like my trauma experience is like overseas in third world countries. Over here, like I've seen the ends of a few fingers cut off, you know, some minor injuries like that, some lacerations. But when it comes to medical here, like I've probably been involved in maybe 10, maybe 12 cardiacs of varying severity where we've RFDS people off.
Yeah,
We
wow.
are very, we are very lucky. These places, like, and they know who we are, they know where we are. If you're calling them and you say the mine name, they're like, yeah. And we know that they're generally pretty close. And we get a lot of good support, especially from RFDS. I was very lucky. Like, I spent half of last year working in RFDS West's industrial health team. I worked for Matt Pepper as an EFSO on a mine. And I was very, very lucky to learn a bit more of how they work internally. Like, we do like coffee in cases and just to have access to some very, very talented, experienced people ranging from doctor to nurse to critical care paramedics, where we had that support. So basically they're the people that you call and you say, I need help, and they're very good at that. But up here, I can't exactly say what they have, but they have some very good drugs. Like I wouldn't, I'm pretty sure like they have, you can do like venous blood gases, you know, they
Oh,
have
wow.
point of care blood testing, they have an i-STAT here,
Yeah.
like they have very good monitors. You know, they now, even end tidal CO2 is becoming more common. It does, I won't get started on that one, it's very frustrating, but generally it's something that they have that half the people don't realize they have it. So it's generally hidden in the bottom of the crash cart, and just, oh, what is this?
And the
Different
ones
story.
in the Zoll, you have to attach it a certain way, and then you
Yeah.
have to like do the thing. There's
Yeah.
like
Do the
you have to do the thing, like you have to
thing.
twist it to make
Yeah.
sure it's like on. And like
Oh,
that's
Bridgie, I was
well,
about
it's
to say to
something.
leave. I was about to say that you could have all the equipment, you just got to make sure they've got the right medic, and then there's gonna be you and me on site going, we got the Zoll, but where's the thing?
It's got to, and like if you don't twist it or and turn it on, like it won't be on at all. And so like you go to a lot of cases like on road and people are like, yeah, I've got the ETCO2 on. I'm like, no, you don't. You
Not a
haven't done
patient,
the
not on.
Well, you, that's like a, that's a really good point, and that does grind my gears at all levels of medical providers. Don't get me wrong, there are some very good people and there are some very experienced nurses and paramedics that we meet, but it is also a spectrum, and I have many cases without saying too much that are the opposite, to the point where you're exposed to writing up things about needle stick injuries and stuff like that. Because I guess people get really complacent. And
Yeah.
unfortunately, you can have all the gear and no idea. And we are in a remote location. And it's, if you don't stage and prep gear correctly, if you don't continuously develop and train, if you don't have a rough plan for the things you're likely to face, you're just setting yourself up for failure.
It's a
And
tricky
I'll
one. It's a tricky one because we definitely need to inoculate ourselves from stress by rehearsals, rehearsals, rehearsals. The unfortunate aspect of that is for the higher clinical skill sets, when something goes wrong, they will have 12 and 24 people just look at them. This is on you, buddy. I'm so glad I'm down here, and this is on you because I've experienced this too. All right, well, you're the clinician. Now it's up to you. And rather than be supported, sometimes you're actually isolated, and then you get judged, and it's like, well, we're not really a crew now, are we? Like,
Yeah, this is feeling less like a team environment.
but this is also why I say, sometimes the right person is a lower skill set because it doesn't matter what skill set you've got sometimes, it's how you actually react or how you can operate when everything goes pear-shaped. What's that quote Kelsey said last year during the Respond conference? It was something about we don't rise.
Oh, to our training, we don't It's something about rising, but
We
like
don't
we
rise to
fall
the
to our
occasion, we
training.
fall to the level of our training. And I agree with that to a certain point because it is true, but there's also some other confounding factors. And I think, Lee, you raised them before, even, hunger, sleep, fatigue, mood, all of those things come into play and how any kind of responder is actually going to react to that moment. It could even be something that triggers them from a past job. So it's
Well, as
interesting.
soon as you're stressed, things become like harder to hold on to, and you're like, you're freaking out a bit, you know? And
Yeah,
we
your
see
hands
that
turn
with
to
like,
feet.
and you're like, oh, and then you're trusted with the sharp thing, right? And you're like,
I remember years ago, Bridgie, and I mean this is even with 10 years experience. I literally ripped out a just an IM injection. How simple are they? And I drew up the drug, and then I dropped it, and it stuck in my own boot. And I literally had all these heads looking at me like,
you're
"Are you
like,
okay before?" I'm like, "I normally am. I'm really sorry." Obviously, I had no one. It was just me, and everyone was looking at me like the higher skill set. And I'm the one who dropped it in my own boot. It literally stuck in my boot. Now you do
didn't
lose
get in your
a
foot,
little
did
bit of credibility. But this is all just part of the clinical game. Hey, Lee, you must have a really understanding partner because
Oh,
you've literally been working in the depths of the ocean. You've been working in the depths of a mine site. Like you keep going underwater or underground for long periods of time and managing dangerous things.
yeah, well, we met on the mine site, met on a gold mine.
There we
She
go.
was in Enviro. We actually got married in Cairns in June.
Oh,
We have a house.
congratulations.
Thank you. We have a house together. We have a macaw, we have a dog, and we have eight
You
chickens.
have a
So
macaw?
I'm a
We have.
what does the macaw get along with the chickens?
He actually
Or do you think he's just like idiots?
Yeah, he copies them. So when they are like
Oh.
sitting in the backyard laying eggs, like he starts copying when they like clucking, like you can hear him.
Oh,
So
that's cool.
he's quite old now, and he's super clever. Like we have to lock the cage because he can open. So he's a menace. When we got him, he was like 3 months old, and I was just like, I have no idea what to do with this raptor. And he has a massive beak that is absolutely terrifying at the start.
What's
But
his
yeah,
name?
Hugo.
Oh, Hugo, that's great.
I was hoping it was Menace.
Yeah, he's got a few other names when he's eating things he shouldn't. But definitely a shout out to my partner, right? She met me at an interesting time of my life when I had just spent a decent amount of time overseas. I came back, it was COVID. I basically an enforced career change, living the life ever since.
What's next?
And there's always controversy about who should intubate, who can't intubate. And when you should or shouldn't. But one of the definitive skills you need out here is a surgical airway, because there will be types of patients. It doesn't matter. Yeah, I think the term is HALO, high acuity, low occurrence. But in that one time, whether it be a massive bit of steak stuck in someone's throat that you can't get out with McGill's, whatever it is, or whether it's severe trauma or airway burns, like what you can do ends at that skill. And beyond that, there's no other options. So there are some things that.
I think a lot can be learned from looking at space medicine in this context too, because the crews that are in space. I mean, we've had people occupying space now for the last 28 years, or longer, without a break. So there's always someone orbiting the planet, and there's never often a physician up there. I mean, the best they've had sometimes is a vet. And so the space agencies spend a significant amount of money looking at what interventions lay clinical people can do, because that's most of the astronauts. And I was even part of a project years ago, a Mars Medical Sim, where we were actually looking at the first pass rates of intubation on lay clinical people. They're researchers, they're all PhDs in different things. But a crew that's going to Mars might not necessarily have access to a doctor. And we know that intubating is probably the best airway. But the first pass rates during that project for these lay clinicians was actually really high. And so although it is quite controversial, we do need to look at small projects like that and then actually have a look at what they're doing in space medicine, because that's the epitome of extreme environment and isolated environment medicine, if you ask me.
All the
They are
The ocean
supported
floor.
with a lot of telehealth. They're supported with quite extensive telehealth. But that said, too, there can be significant delays in those telehealth conversations as well because of equipment failures, solar flares, geomagnetic storms. Who knows? And so, yeah, I just think there's a lot we can learn. I mean, this is, when people talk about wasting money going to space, I think, wow, have you ever heated up a set of noodles in a microwave? You can thank space for that. Have you ever used your iPhone to take a photo or something? Or you can thank, the people who went to space for that. There's so many inventions that have come from getting people into space safer that I think people are so ignorant to it. But yeah, I find it an interesting discussion, Lee, because there's so many opinions about what people can do when, when your back is up against a wall and you have no other choice. Having the knowledge to perform a lay person surgical airway might be the best chance that person has. Now, it's a delicate see sort of balance because you also don't want someone to stab someone in the throat who didn't need it. But
Yes.
again, that's where we can support these things with the right structures, policies, procedures, and training if we can, because then, I mean, that's the very definition of remote austere or extreme environment medicine.
People get very protective of their scopes as well, I think.
You
You
mean
know,
tribal?
it's like, that's my scope. But I think when we look at it as like sort of, a risk benefit analysis, and like you said, like the low occurrence, high risk, there are these skills that it's like, okay, that's going to have like a huge benefit if we act like have at least one person that knows how to do that in one of these really remote environments.
And you know what? Those halo situations, low occurrence will mean that people do not have much experience. And there's an irony because, Lee was even mentioning before that, even in their industry, they don't get that much time for training. And, I look at paramed, nursing, medicine across the board. People are so fatigued from shifts that often they don't get enough time
Oh,
to
yeah, we're
train.
not training.
And although everyone is governed by a certain amount of hours of CPD, that
I mean, yes, we
varies.
are training.
Well, that it varies so significantly that you can't actually benchmark appropriately what people are doing to maintain a certain skill set. So it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing. But Lee, I really appreciate your time today because it's a really good insight into an industry in medicine that just, few venture into and even, less know about. Have you got any insights to anyone who is considering making a leap into the gas resource underground or mining industry? Got a pearl of wisdom for them.
Oh, ooh, that's rough.
You're on the spot.
Yeah. A, train, and B, know what you have when you get to a site, right? The first thing I do, I go to sites, and I look through their stuff, whether it be a fire truck or their crash cart. I give myself some rough understanding of what I have. Because sometimes, just thou shalt not assume, right? Don't assume that the fire truck is full of water. Don't assume that it's going to start when you need it to start. Go out and start it and make sure it does start. Like,
Yeah.
and if you're a paramedic, open your med bag. Look, was it packed correctly in line with the way they said it was going to be packed?
That kit and equipment preparation is just all part of stress inoculation, and the more professionally we can approach that, I think the more capable and prepared we will be. Folks, that's Pod X Medicine with Lee Burton, Sonny and Bridgie today. If you like what you heard, you can find us at academyxmedicine.com.au. Have a look at what we're doing. We are growing a community of extreme environment medics across the breadth of extreme environment medicine in the Southern Hemisphere. Until then, thank you.